My name is Russell. I'm an alcoholic member of the South Dixie Group. It's good to be here. Good to see you guys. It's always good to be up here. Ever since this group started, I think I've been doing the Step Series every year since it started up, and it's always good to be here. I want to share a few things with you. I know it's been kind of rough the last few weeks, you know, 6 and 7. It's hard to have a lot of fun time with 6 and 7, since it has to do with developing something called humility. I don't have much of that, but getting at a point where you're really getting serious about the God thing. And, you know, it's easiest. I haven't found an extra drink. Well, I'm in my 43rd year of sobriety. So it's relatively, I don't want to say it's easy, but it's certainly commonplace, I believe. This is all my opinion, you understand? You know, based upon my almost 43 years of experience in AA. So I can be wrong. I can be wrong. I don't think so, but they chose me to share my experience, strength, and hope. So I'm just telling you my experience. And maybe your experience will be different. When you have a month or two or a year or three or four or five, you have a certain experience. And when you have, when you're in your 43rd year, you have an experience. You see a lot of people. You see a lot of people make it. You see a lot of people not make it. When I first came in, the first 5 or 10 years, I thought everybody got sober in AA. You know why I thought everybody got sober in AA forever? Because everybody was sober. Everybody was sober. I mean, sure, they slip and slide. I had 3 weeks that I slipped, but then they come in and they get sober. Everybody got sober. So I thought everybody got sober in AA. But now I'm in my 43rd year. Sponsored hundreds of men. The landscape I look at in AA, what I look at, when I look out there, I see hardly anybody staying sober. Isn't that weird? I see them stay sober for 10 years, 15 years. I see a bunch of 20 years. I don't see a lot of 30 years. I don't see a lot of 40 years or 50 years. I don't see a lot of 35 years. I have guys that have 30 years or 35 years or 25 years that ask me to sponsor them because they're having a rough time. They're physically sober, but they're having a rough time. They're not happy with their sobriety. And so what I see is I see a lot of people staying sober for 10, 15, or 20 years and then drinking again. That's what I see. And AA's been around for 97 years. I think it's 97 from 1935. I haven't done the math, but you would think if there were, you know, tons of people staying sober for 30 years, there'd be a lot of them people in meetings. And you sort of look around the room at meetings, and if you have one guy with 40 years, you're lucky, and it'll only be probably one guy. And then maybe somebody will have somebody with 30 years, maybe have a lot of 20 years. And I sort of understand it because I've been through the deal now. I've been through 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 40, I've been through it. And so I see things differently, my perspective. How do they say, you know, you get a new perspective by repeated humiliation, this final question of self-sufficiency. So when I first came in for the first 20 years, Bill Wilson was God. I know he's not God. But to me, Bill Wilson was, man, if you wanted to be great in AA, that must be Bill Wilson. But now I'm grown up. I'm a grown-up man, and I say there's only one who has soul power, and that one is God. And it's not Bill Wilson. It's not AA. It's not the trustees. It's not me. It's not anybody in this deal. And now I know the truth. And the truth is this. Bill Wilson wrote a book when he was 5 years. I believe it's divinely inspired because I believe in God, because I've sponsored a lot of guys for 5 years, and I had 5 years. And nobody with 5 years could put together what Bill Wilson put together, what he wrote down. So I applaud him for that. He allowed the God to use him as a vehicle. And what I see is in that book, the most important steps to me in my life as a guy with 43, the most important steps to me are the 6th and 7th step. Isn't that weird? Apparently, they're also important to other people because to me, the 6th and 7th step are the steps that separate the men from the boys. They're the steps that separate the men from the boys. And isn't it interesting? If you read the 12 and 12, it says in the 6th step, this is the step that separates the men from the boys. And yet, when Bill Wilson wrote the big book, 6 and 7 were two paragraphs. Two paragraphs. You know why they were two paragraphs? Because he had little experience with 6 and 7. Because in 5 years, you don't have much experience with 6 and 7. Because in 10 years, you don't have much experience with 6 and 7. And you're so busy trying to dodge the arrows and trying to manage your life and trying to escape the worldly clamors or looks after the worldly clamors and run around trying to figure out what's going on. So busy thinking now that you have double digit sobriety, you'll be okay. You know, having fun in AA and sucking your thumb in AA and having being excited in AA and then being down in the dumps. You got so much stuff going on. And somewhere along the line, with all the sets, all the sponsors, and all the people and the fellowship and everything, doing everything, and I did everything. For most of us, for many of us, and I know quite a few of them, AA stops working. And the crazy thing is when AA stops working, you don't realize it stopped working because you're not necessarily automatically drink. It's not like it stops working and you drink. What happens is it stops working and you don't know it stops working and you think it's working because you're not drinking, but the meetings are getting boring and you're getting tired. Like it says in the big book, it says things like this. Here and then, every once in a while, a former drinker says, feel better, look better, having a better time. This is what it says in Vision to You. He says, I don't miss it at all. We laugh at such Sally. We know he'll try the old game again because he's not happy with his sobriety. Soon he'll try the old game again. You know, the loneliness as few do because he's not happy. Do you think it's possible to have 10 years sobriety and not be happy? You think it's possible to have 15 years sobriety and not be happy? How about 25 years sobriety and not be happy? And I thought by the time I had 10 years, I had made it. Man, I'll tell you, it was all downhill from there. And it was all downhill from there, quite frankly. You think the years make it, you know? But what happens when it's not working for you and you don't know why it's not working for you and you know you're not excited and you're not happy and you go to a meeting to find out what the problem is? And all they talk about is don't drink and go to meetings. They say things to you like, well, just start sponsoring people. And you say, but I am sponsoring 10 people. Because they say nothing proves physical sobriety more than intensive work with alcoholics. But you are intensively working with alcoholics. And you know something? Because of that, you're not drinking. But you're still not happy. You're using your sponsorship of alcoholics to work almost like aspirin. You sponsor a guy. You speak to a guy. You do whatever you have to do. You do service, and you're okay for a few hours. And so it works. You don't drink. Maybe you'll make 20 years, but you're not happy with your sobriety. And you think you'll hear about what the problem is at meetings, because the meetings, God bless them, the most important people in meetings are newcomers. It's all about drinking or not drinking or being in the first 5 years. But you've got 20 years, and you've got 15 years, and you're worried about money again, and you're worried about lust, you're worried about this, you got all sorts of things, and nobody in the meetings are talking about, you don't got no guys with 20, 25 years, 30 years talking about how they're bankrupt or they're worried or they got cancer. You don't have any of that stuff going on because the newcomer wouldn't even identify with it. Maybe that's the reason. Maybe it's just because of pride. There's no old-timer stuff. There's no 20-year stuff going on. The meetings are 15 or 30 years. What do you do if you're a 30-year, if you got 30 years or 25 years or 15 years? And every meeting you go to, it's all about the new guy. I'm not saying that's bad or good. It just is. All of a sudden, you know, what the pain is in your heart, which is six-step pain, is not being helped because they're not talking about how to grow in the image and likeness of your creator. You're not even sure who your creator is. You're not even sure you believe in God, although you tell yourself things that alcoholics lie to themselves. They're delusional. They can't separate the truth from the false. That's if they're drinking or not drinking. They say things like, I don't care what other people think about me, and all they do is worry about what other people think about me. They really tell themselves they don't give a crap what other people think about them when they're most worried about what other people are thinking about them. And when you got a mind that works like that, you know, you can't ever be sure about your own thinking. You know, when you got 1 year or 2 years or 5 years, maybe even 10 years, it's easy to go to meetings sometimes and sort of get something out of them. But what happens when you have 15, 20 years and you're looking for somebody to help you? Now, you may be lucky. You may get a sponsor who's able to help you or something like that. And so what happens is here's Bill Wilson. He writes this big book, Divinely Inspired, 2 paragraphs on 6 and 7. Now, by the time he had 17 years, this is Bill Wilson, guy who knows the most about it, him and Dr. Bob, 17 years, he writes the 12 and 12. All of a sudden, the 12 and 12 has 2 chapters on 6 and 7. How come 17 years later, he's writing 2 chapters on 6 and 7? Because he had 17 years and he was deep in 6 and 7. He understood that there were real problems going on. So he writes 2 chapters on 6 and 7. And you know what he says about 6? He says, this is a step that separates the men from the boys. It's funny. He didn't write that about 6 when he had 5 years. When he had 5 years, he didn't write this is the step. You know what he wrote? He wrote like 2 lines. And then he said, and we get on our knees and we say this prayer. We're now done with 7. You know what I mean? That's what, because his experience at that time was not at a point where he needed to work 6 and 7 and get serious about God. You know, about the time you start getting cancer and you realize that you're going to die, either with cancer or you realize you're not going to be around for a while. You know, I mean, I hate to be morbid, but it's the truth. You know, you got to, at some point in time, you have to accept reality, and you're not 18, 19, and 20 years old, and you're not going to live forever. At some point when things get real, you'd be surprised how much you start thinking about things like God. Stop thinking about
sex.
You stop girls. You stop thinking about the man or the this or the that or the clothes. About the time you start to think about your mortality and whether you're going to live or die and how long you're going to live. And I'll give you the same. It's not at 18 years of age and it's not at 30 years of age. Okay. But about the time that starts happening, AA, what AA is all about and what the steps are all about, take on a whole different deal because you're in a whole different place in your life. And the things that seem so important, the money, the property, the prestige, you know, they sort of like, you sort of like resigned yourself to the fact that you're probably not going to be a billionaire. You're not going to win the Powerball. And you're just going along every day and you're worried about, you know, making money and you're worried about this and all the world, all the things that happen in the world. And you're doing everything, but it's just, you're not being rocked in the fourth dimension. And all of a sudden you start looking around, what's wrong with me? You know, and you're not even thinking about the drinking anymore, really. You're just thinking about when are you going to get the promise of not being worried about financial insecurity? When are you going to stop worrying about what other people think about you? Fear of people and economic insecurity. When are you going to start feeling, when are you going to experience the new freedom? And you don't know who to ask at the AA meetings how to do that because you don't hear anybody talking about it. Because all the meetings are key to don't drink even if your ass falls off. And you're not drinking. And so it's 17 years, Bill Wilson, is writing the 6th step and the 7th step, and this is the step that separates men from boys, and a well-loved clergyman. All of a sudden, he's bringing his clergyman in there. And Dowling says, this is the step that separates men from the boys. The men are those who are trying to grow in the image and likeness of their creator, the image and likeness of God, and it's getting serious. And some people, what, 1 in 100, 1 in 200, look at that thing and say, I got to start taking the God thing serious. And they get serious about it, okay? But most people don't. They don't. Somehow, some way, they just sort of settle for the fact, well, not drinking is good enough. But not drinking is really not good enough. The person who is totally concentrated on not drinking will drink. I mean, just will, you know, because he's missing the point. Because the main object of this book is to find the power by which you can live. Not drink, by which you can live. That means we wrote a book where, of course, we're going to talk about God. And here's where the problem happens with alcoholics. This idea that God can be a pinch hitter, you can talk about him every once in a while, and you can think about him, but the bottom line is all you have to do is do a 4th step or a 5th step. All you have to do is sponsor somebody or go to meetings. Sometimes you go to meetings. You hear a lot of people saying, I drank because I stopped going to meetings. So you start thinking that's why people drink because they stopped going to meetings, but you don't realize, you don't go any farther than that. You don't ask yourself the question, why did they stop going to meetings? Because they weren't getting anything out of the meetings. Because the meetings weren't talking to them. And they were looking at the worldly clamors. They were looking at all the bright and shiny things around them. And they lost interest. You know, they just weren't getting the medicine. And then what do you see? Then you see the one thing that nobody in AA knows about. The best kept secret in AA, except when it was happening, you see at 20 years sobriety, Bill Wilson is popping LSD because he's not happy with his sobriety. That's why you take LSD or drugs or Xanax. How many people do you think I know that got 11, 12, 15 years, went to a psychiatrist because they weren't happy with their sobriety? They had some guy who's not even alcoholic. I feel funny. I feel tired. I can't get sleep. And what do I do? And says, you know, why don't you chew on some of these? I don't even know what the drug of the moment is. Seroquel? I mean, there's so many of them. Percocet. I mean, I don't even know whatever it is. You go up to an expert who is trying to sell, you know, who's being talked to by pharmaceutical salesmen, And you tell them that you're nervous, you're irritable, you know, you can't get involved in any addictive stuff. Maybe you tell me or not, but this is it. You can't sleep at night. He hands you a script. Because what he's really saying in his mind, he says, I don't know what the flip is wrong with you, but why don't you chew on this shit so I can work with on somebody who has a real problem, okay? Because I have no idea what your deal is, but there's something going on in you and I can't explain it. You know, I just don't know. And the next thing you know, you're drinking or you're drunk. And the next thing that happens is Bill Wilson almost goes down to the tubes, gets depressed. Thank God he didn't drink, you know, but and then he writes an essay. He comes out of it. The essay is called The Next Frontier, talking about what happened to him and what he learned at 20, 21, 22, 23 years sobriety when he crashed and burned. And he couldn't answer the question. He was baffled by not only him. He said, I see many old timers, guys with a lot of time. At that time, he had the most time, 23 years when he wrote. But other guys at 22, why they're unhappy. He says, I can see there are people that seem to be rocking the fourth dimension, that he calls them benighted ones. And he says, maybe they will be the spearhead for the next major development in AA. And he talks about how he screwed up. Dr. Bob saw it. Dr. Bob was a big, intense God guy. You know, I'm not going to go through all the ways I can prove that to you. You have to read Dr. Bob, the good old timers. You went up to Dr. Bob and said, what's all this first things first? He said, seek you first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all things will be added unto you. Dr. Bob, when he sponsored, when he 12-stepped Clarence the Brewmaster, the first thing he said to the kid, who was 35 years old in bed, in the hospital bed, is he said, do you believe in God? First thing, if you say that to somebody, you know, around here, you know what I mean? They'll say you're going to kill a newcomer. First thing he said, you believe in God? And Clarence says, well, what does that do with it? And Dr. Bob says, everything. Well, I guess I do guess nothing. You either do or you don't. He says, well, I do. He says, good. Now we're getting somewhere. Get down on your knees. We're going to pray to God. Well, I don't know how to pray. That's okay. You just follow me and do what I said. And Clarence said, there were no suggestions. I did what I was ordered to do. That's why Dr. Bob's last words to Bill Wilson were, because he saw what's going on. He said, Bill, let's not screw this thing up. Let's keep it simple. So I'll ask people things like this. Or ask yourself things like this. Do you believe in the big book? And they'll say, sure, I absolutely believe in the big book. I've read it a million times. They said, you believe in the big book, right? Now let me ask you another question. Do you believe the big book? They're two different questions. First question is, do you believe in the big book? Yeah, I believe in the big book. Everybody believes in the big book. Do you believe the big book? Well, yeah, sure. I said, so you believe there is one who has all power, and that one is God. You believe there's one that has all power, that one is God. And they say, well, one, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of them, a lot of ways, a lot of different circles. So you don't really believe there's one who has all the power. There's one God. You don't believe that. And you believe he has all power. You believe he's sovereign, has all power. Everything is under him. Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. Well, do you believe God is everything or he's nothing? He's everything in your life. Do you believe, like it says in the big book, that the great fact is this, that God has to be the central fact of your life? Do you believe that? So do you believe that half measures avail you nothing? Do you believe that if you don't get rid of all your ideas, the results is nil? And you just go down the list. Do you ever apologize for God in meetings? Do you feel upset when people talk about God in meetings? Do you ever say, oh, I'm sorry to mention God? Or do you ever think of ways of not mentioning God, put it in like some sort of different terms so people will like you and everything like that? I said, yeah, what about that part where it says we never apologize for God? All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. Instead, they let him demonstrate in their lives through their testimony what he's done for them. And once we begin to outgrow fear, do you believe in that? Do you believe, what about that part in the big book where it says, job or no job, wife or no job, you can recover if you believe in God, you give your life to God, it's all that. What about that part in the big book where it says, but we won't be able to see you? What about you, Bill Wilson? He says, we don't know that. But the bottom line is God will determine that, and your real reliance has to be on him. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. He will even show you who to hang out with. You believe all that stuff? See the way your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to that. Yeah, do you believe? I mean, you believe in the big book, but you believe everything the big book says. And then they point to Appendix 2, and they say, well, Appendix 2 says it can say whatever I want it to say. So you use the appendix too. It's basically wiping out the entire big book and, you know, just do it the way you want to do it. The way you read, as I understand them, is every word and every sentence in the big book is sort of like up for grabs. In other words, the big book really doesn't mean anything. There's my program, there's your program, there's this program, there's 2,000 different programs, and it's sort of like woke AA, you know what I mean? There is no truth. The truth is whatever I want the truth to be. So that's what you're like, woke AA, you know, like that's what's going on today. It's no truth. So then you don't have to worry about rigorous honesty. You don't have to worry about whether you're being rigorous or honest because you're honest if you think you're honest. And this is your feeling. It's all based upon your feelings. Is that how it works? So that's, and so Bill Wilson realized, he said, my real problem was, the real problem with alcoholics is unhealthy dependencies. Dependence on anything else. And this is what happened to me. I depend on everything else instead of God. People, places, and things, and even my dependency on AA. Can you get that? I know I'm AA. Now, there's going to be a coming time where AA is going to let you down. Your sponsor is going to let you down. Everybody's going to let you down. And you're going to be floating around trying to figure out what the hell is wrong with me. And that's what's going to happen. That's the deal. What happens when that happens? I don't know whether you guys have ever had the experience of dealing with the people I deal with who have 22 years sobriety and drink, 19 years sobriety and drink, 15 years sobriety and drink, 30 years sobriety and drink. Okay, it gives you a whole new perspective on this deal. So you see everybody staying sober, and I see nobody staying sober. Very, very few people staying sober after 20 years. It like drops down like whack, like that. Everybody's got the 1 year, the 2 years. You get up to like 10 years, then it's two people. You get up to like 15 years, one guy, 7 years. Then you get to 20 years, one guy. Then it like drops off all the way down to 40, and then there's maybe one guy or 30. And you don't see that. That's what I see. That's who I deal with. You know what I mean? So I have a heart for old-timers, for guys who have time. But, you know, that's just what I see. That's my experience. And that was my experience with me. At 10 years, I crashed. I crashed at 10 years. And I happened to be looking around. And thank God. You see, you can crash. One way to crash is you drink. Another way to crash is like Bill Wilson did and like what I did and other people work is that's an emotional crash. You get super depressed, whatever you want to say, and A, it's not working, but you don't drink. And you're going to meetings, and you're depressed, and you don't know what to do. And I run into my Eskimo, my guy, and he says, you know, you need to start going to Bible study. And you think he's crazy because you know in AA you're not allowed to do that. Because they tell you. Everybody's saying I'm spiritual, not religious. So you know religion is bad. I know the big book says we lose prejudice against organized religion. We begin to see where religious people are right. I know Dr. Bob, the good book, and the good old time, says the books we found absolutely essential were 1 Corinthians 13, Sermon on the Mount, and the book of James. I know the big book says be the good Samaritan, which is out of the book of Luke. I know there's tons of stuff in the big book about the Bible. I know they have the St. Francis prayer. But I somehow got the absolute, pure, absolute idea, hanging in AA meetings, that religion was bad. You know, I mean, we got the recovering Catholics, we got the hate the church and everything like that. And after all, we got that other thing going for us that all alcoholics have. We hate religious people. We hate religions. You know, I mean, that's not what it says. What does it say in chapter of the agnostics? It says, of course, we're going to talk about God. Here's where the problem happens with alcoholics. So we understand that one of the symptoms of being a consequence of being an alcoholic. If you hate the idea of religion, you hate the idea of God and people telling you what to do. So you're already bought into the idea that God is terrible and the religion is terrible and all this stuff is terrible. You understand? So they're ready to hear that stuff. And then everybody's running around saying, I'm spiritual, not religious, which sounds like it's not good to be religious, especially if you're in AA. And now you're dying and you're a thumb-sucking crybaby and you got 10, 12, 15 years. And you go up to a guy you respect, he says, you know, you need to start going to Bible study. You need to take this to the next level and read the books. And your initial reaction is, this is crazy. But, of course, if you're approached by somebody who's sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and emotionally sober and not crazy, and you are crazy, whatever they say to you is going to sound crazy to you. So what happens is, if you're lucky, you're so desperate then you get something called willingness and open-mindedness, and you do it anyway. Now, what do you do when you start doing it anyway, and you go to the Bible study? What do you do when it starts working? And that's the real problem. What do you do when somebody tells you to do something that you don't want to do, and you end up doing it, and it works, and you start feeling good? You say, well, I got to stop this shit now. Next thing you know, you're doing it, and it's working. And so you don't need proof, because it's working for you. You just want more of it, and it's working, and it's working. And then you start reading things in the big book that you never saw before. You start reading the part of the big book where it says we encourage church membership to say, hey, they said that. Because most of us belong to such organizations. People say, ah, I did. Yeah, it's written right there in the big book. But they never talk about that stuff. I mean, to believe in God, but not really believe God. To believe in God, here's the story. I got a story. I like stories, you know. And whenever I'm given a story, because each of us get stories, you need to recognize it's a story when you get it. Sometimes things happen to you, and you complain about it, or you worry about it, or maybe you learn something, but you don't realize you're being given a testimony. So the other night, Tuesday night, I'm approached by a reaction, so I'll tell you about it. And he says, I did the first step, but you know me, you know, don't forget about it. Who knows what step I did? You know, as a matter of fact, I think that's 30 million talks, so what was that all about? You know, and anyway, we could name him. And he comes up to me and he says this. This is an example of alcoholism and the truth and rigorous honesty and how we fool ourselves. And he says this to me. This is what he says to me. Can I ask you a question? And I say, yes, I'll try to answer any question I can. Sometimes I say, I just don't know. And he says, well, I'm broke and I'm in a halfway house. And somebody just wrote me a check for $1,000 to try to help me out and gave me a check. And my roommate said to me, that's a blessing from God. And he says, you know, I believe in God, but I don't think it's a blessing from God. He says, I believe in God, but I don't think it's a blessing from God. I'm just told you the story. So he comes up to you and he says that. And so he looks at me and says, so what do you think? And I said, I think you don't believe in God. I think you don't believe in God. See, I believe in God. I'm born again Christian. I believe in God. This is what I think. I think anything that happens to me that's good is a blessing from God. I think anything that happens to me that's bad or looks bad is a blessing from God. I think all things work for good for those who love the Lord. I think if something happens to me that's rough and that's bad, God is giving me that and allowing that to happen to me because he is sovereign, because there is one who has all power. And I believe the book that it says about acceptance, nothing happens to God's world unless he deems it to happen. And there's a reason for it, to train me so I'll grow up to be a man and I'll get closer to him. So I believe there's nothing that happens that isn't from God. And somehow with my attitude, I can grow up. So I believe everything is from God because I believe in God. Because I believe God is sovereign and there is one who has all power. I believe my alcoholism is from God. I'm privileged to be an alcoholic. If I was an alcoholic, I'd be like normal. Who the hell would ever want that? You know what I mean? I wouldn't be able to go to meetings or anything or try to help people or do anything or have a purpose in life. I believe in God. You don't believe in God. You believe that if something happens, you know, maybe it's good, maybe it's bad. Maybe one day you're promoted, maybe one day you're shot. It's whatever happens, happens. You believe in fate, you know, so that's why you live a life of fear. I believe in God. That's why I believe a life of hope. That's why I live a life of hope. But here's the problem. The problem is you tell yourself you believe in God, but you really don't. You don't live like you believe in God. You don't think you believe in God. And somebody said, so what did he say? I said, he didn't say anything. He just had his mouth open looking at me. You see, rigorous honesty is difficult. You see, sometimes you just need to hear the truth straight out. And then all of a sudden, and sometimes the truth hurts. Sometimes the truth sometimes you walk out of a meeting and you hear somebody talk and you say, you know, I don't like that guy. I don't like the way he talks. He's like an odor, you know, he's obnoxious, whatever it is. But sometimes that's the only thing that alcoholics remember. 3 weeks later, they remember that one talk where the guy was such an idiot. You know, they like to be entertained. It's nice to give a banquet talk, I call it. Banquet talks where, you know, everybody's eating or they're showing up or giving a convention talk. What it was like, what happened. You talk about the drinking, the funny stories, the craziness, what happened, what it's like now. So nobody's being pierced. nobody's really learning that necessarily anything. It's just being sort of uplifted. It's a fun talk and some spiritual talk. But every once in a while, if you're an alcoholic, if you want to stay sober, you got to be sort of, well, how do they say we get a new perspective? Repeated humiliations and the final question of our self-sufficiency. It doesn't say we yuck it up. You know, so here's a thought. Here's a thought. Here's a story. Bad story. You've heard it before, but I'll tell you a little bit differently because it's a recent story. And this is what happens when you start to buy into this God thing. So when I was 2 months sober, I didn't have any money. I was broke. I was married. I had a couple of kids. So I was behind the rent. Imagine what happens if you're 3 months sober. If you can ever imagine this, being sober and broke. I don't know whether you guys have ever experienced what it's like to have being sober and broke. For a man, it doesn't feel good. I have a feeling for a woman, it doesn't feel good. You know, you feel powerless, you're scared and everything like that. You lose sleep at night. And I didn't talk about it in my group because, not that I cared what they thought about me, but, you know, I'm not going to share that the big shot lawyer was broke. You know, I'm not going to tell them that. It's none of the business. But things got so bad, I finally shared it with my sponsor. Now I've got 3 months and I tell my sponsor that I'm broke and I don't have any money and I'm 2 months behind the rent and blah, blah, blah. So I'm expecting maybe he'll give me $1,000 like this guy got or something that might help me out. This is my sponsor. And he says this to me, how to solve that problem. And I said, really? I said, absolutely. I said, oh, thank God. I told my sponsor. He says, so how do I? He says, you need to start making coffee for the group. And I'm looking at him because I'm convinced that I didn't really make myself clear. You know what I mean? He obviously didn't understand what I was saying. I could have explained better. You know, so I'm talking about money. You know, it's not important. It's just right up there with oxygen. He's talking about it. Hey, it's good. What are you doing? You have money problems or stuff like that. So he marches me over. I find him to the coffee pot. He shows me how to make coffee, set up the chairs and everything. And the next day I'm supposed to go there, but no money came in and I was depressed. As a matter of fact, alcoholics don't get depressed. I was like very depressed. You know what I mean? And I didn't want to go, but I had to go. Why did I have to go? Because I had to make the coffee for the stupid group. And if I didn't show up to make the coffee, what would they think about me? Not that I give a shit what other people think about me, but I showed up and I made the coffee. And I did that for 18 months, making coffee. After 3 months, the money came in. I mean, thank God I didn't drink. And I go to these meetings to make the coffee. And so it was the solution to my problem. Even though I didn't think it was, I thought the solution was money. Solution was, you know, making the coffee for the group. Some guy came up to me. I told him, this is true. He came up to me after 3 months and said, I'll make the coffee. I said, I'm the coffee maker. So here's the story. So a week ago, I got some very, very bad financial news. You know, I just thought, you know, it can happen at 74 years of age. You know, I know guys, you wouldn't believe the stuff I've seen. I saw a guy lose his pension at 60 years of age, worked 40, 73, and lost his entire pension. I mean, crap can happen to you. Listen, crap can happen to you because you cause it, and crap can just happen to you because shit happens. You know? You could walk into the doctor, you know, the old story with the doctor, I've got some bad news and some very bad news. Well, what's the very bad news? He says, you got 3 months to live, you got cancer. Well, what's the bad news? He says, you got Alzheimer's disease. Thank God, I thought you were going to tell me I had cancer. Yeah, I mean, shit happens. You know what I mean? Stuff can happen to you. So I got some bad financial news. So, you know, I did what I did. I said, because of this program and everything, I didn't like it. I didn't feel easy about it. But you know something? I prayed to God that I prayed to God not for money. I prayed to God that I'd be able to be a good witness and be able to have a learning experience and get closer to him and things like that and help other people and some other things like that. And then I go along to my meetings and I do my deal and everything like that. So on the very day I got the bad financial news, at 10 o'clock in the morning, I get a call from a sponsor. He tells me about some very bad things he's going through with his finances. I share with him what happened to me. I said, this is common. You know, it happened to me. It happens to other people. You're going to get through this. And I talk, whatever I say to them, I start sharing what's going on and what went on with me, with my sponsor and everything like this. And you'll get through this. And I start basically telling them what the deal is. 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I get a call from another sponsor who's going through a real rough time because he's got some very bad financial news. Apparently there's some sort of virus going around. Okay. got bad financial news. And so I share with him everything I shared with the first guy. Plus, I say, and as a matter of fact, this very morning, I got a call from another guy who had financial. So it's, you're going to survive, you know, blah, blah, blah. He says, thank you. 9 o'clock at night, 9:30 at night, I'm watching TV. One of my favorite shows where people are being killed, bloody karate kicks and things like that. You know, I just, my wife likes all the romantic stuff. I ain't watching unless somebody gets killed. In any event, I get a call from a guy I haven't spoken to in 2 years. He's 78 years old. He's just lost his job. He moved out of town with his wife. He has no income. He's 78 years old. Nobody's going to hire him. And we talk for a while. And I tell him everything about me. I tell him everything about the story. And he said to me, I didn't know who I should call, so I prayed about it, and your name came up. I said, why don't you call Russell? So he calls me up, 9:30 at night, mind you. I tell him about, you know, what happened with my first sponsor. I told him what happened with me this morning. I told him about the first guy. I told him about the second guy. I speak to him. I actually gave him some good advice that he was really appreciative about as to what to do and how he should do it. And we hang up the phone, and I start thinking. I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, on the very day I got this financial news, I get a call at 10 o'clock about a guy who's got bad financial news, and I work with him. I get a call at 1 o'clock by another guy who's got bad financial news, and at 9:30 at night, I'm called by another guy because he needs help with some bad financial news. And I start thinking about my sponsor who said, I got the solution for you. You need to make coffee for the group. And I look up at the sky, because I'm convinced that's where Jesus is, somewhere up in the sky. And I say, you're like flipping incredible. It's always the coffee with you. With you, it's always the flipping coffee. I need the money. You tell me I need to start making coffee. It's always service and helping other people in the coffee for you. But the only reason I feel that way, and I know he's with me, and I feel that way, is because I'm a believer. So I don't focus on, you know, the problem. I focus on how God's trying to change me and how he's trying to help me. None of this has anything to do with the 10th step. Or maybe it has a lot to do with the 10th step. I'll talk a little bit more about it. I'll do 10 and 11 next week, maybe. I'm not promising anything. So thank you.